Hello and welcome to Natural Health with CNM, the College of Naturopathic Medicine. I'm your host, Michelle Sanchez. In today's episode, I'm joined by leading clinician and reproductive expert, Leah Heckman. Leah will be discussing endometriosis and explaining what it is, the symptoms to look out for, and the common causes and triggers. She'll also be giving us insight into how the gut and the immune system play a role in endometriosis and how it can be managed naturopathically through diet, lifestyle, and key nutrients. Leah is an experienced and respected clinician and has been in private practice for over 20 years. She specializes in fertility, pregnancy, and reproductive medicine and holds fellowships and memberships with many international organizations. She sits on multiple scientific advisory boards and is a past president of the NHAA. She has completed extensive advanced training and is currently completing her PhD through the School of Women's and Children's Health at the University of New South Wales in Australia. Her research is exploring ovarian biomarkers in women with polycystic ovarian syndrome and premature ovarian failure. Leah is the director of the Natural Health and Fertility Centre in Sydney, Australia. And over the years, she has helped thousands of couples conceive healthy, vibrant children, often in situations where they were told there was no hope left. She's a keynote speaker at conferences locally and internationally, and is the author of multiple seminal naturopathic textbooks and a contributor to journals and other texts within the naturopathic and functional medicine areas, as well as general gynecology, fertility, and infertility. Leah is also a CNN patron and a regular media spokesperson for her profession. And most importantly, she's a mother of two gorgeous boys who keep her grounded, humbled, and consciously aware. Hi, Leah. Welcome. And thank you for joining me today. It's an absolute pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, endometriosis is a complex and multifaceted chronic inflammatory condition that affects not only the reproductive system, but the whole body. And you're going to help us unpack endometriosis today and give our listeners a greater understanding of the condition and what can be done naturopathically to support the body to manage endometriosis. But before we get started, can you please tell us a little bit about yourself and your experience as a clinician?
Look, thank you. I think endometriosis is such a misunderstood condition and it's compartmentalized a little bit too readily. And unfortunately, too many people are suffering around the world. And so I think it's so wonderful to be able to discuss this and get this information out there. My background is that I'm in Australia, in Sydney, and I'm a naturopath. I've been in practice for nearly 25 years now. I particularly focus on reproductive health, particularly infertility. And I've got a very special interest in endometriosis, both from my own experience and also because I think we can make so much of a difference for women that are experiencing it. And it's been fascinating to, you know, be a naturopath for so long now and to be able to see the changes in our understanding of endometriosis and our treatment of endometriosis. And I think, you know, we're almost only really just touching the surface of our depth of understanding as research unravels and evolves over time now. So it's a very, very fascinating area. And I think, you know, for anyone that's listening, it's a condition that, you know, your number one rule is if you don't have a healthcare team that are supportive, listening to you and giving you options, then it's really important that your number one strategy is to get the best healthcare team around you.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. And I think when women do have the condition, they're, you know, sort of left in the dark and they're sort of desperate because they've got all these symptoms going on and they just don't know what to do next or where to get help quite often.
And it's interesting because, you know, I'll treat women predominantly in Australia, but I certainly treat women all around the world. And it's fascinating to sort of look at the different countries and their approaches to it. And, you know, the conventional medical model is pain medication or hormonal blocking, essentially by putting women on the contraceptive pill or using a medication called Visane, which is a progesterone, or like it's a progestin, so it's a progesterone mimic hormone, or, you know, they'll give women a Mirena, which secretes progesterone as well. And it's basically just to hold the body in place and just block the whole system. But, you know, if we think about our understanding of endometriosis historically versus currently, historically it was that it was purely limited to the reproductive system and it was just a gynecological condition. And so if you stop the hormones, then you stopped it. But now we understand that endometriosis, you know, it's such a complicated condition, and essentially it's where endometriosis is, you know, endometrial-like cells. So essentially a woman has a uterus and she has a lining within that uterus that either sheds and becomes her menstrual period or it implants a baby, and those cells can be mimicked in other parts of the body and they can lay down on other tissues. And so a woman with endometriosis, it's not just limited to her reproductive system, and she can have these endometrial-like cells anywhere from her bladder to her digestive organs to her kidneys and, unfortunately, to things like her lungs and even her brain. And we now know that, you know, endometriosis, so these endometrial-like cells, have been detected in both boys and girls, and men and women. So it's not just limited to women, but certainly also not just limited to women of reproductive age. You know, so there are girls that are experiencing it before their first period, and then there are women that are experiencing it after menopause. So we know that just blocking the hormone pathway is not the answer.
No, absolutely. Wow, that's it's amazing the research that's coming out, and the fact that, that you know, that it's affecting, you know, men as well. That's incredible. So how does endometriosis present normally? What are some of the symptoms, you know, people will experience?
So for simplicity, if you let me, let's talk about it and its presentation in women of reproductive age, and then we can certainly explore the other parameters, but it gets too complicated when you start looking at all the other areas of it. But women of reproductive age, it's basically where a woman whose period deviates from, in inverted commas, normal. So a normal, in inverted commas, period is where she loses between 80 and 120 mils of blood per period, which is really not a lot of blood. Mm. It's where her period, she experiences pain, which is debilitating and interferes with her life, both during her period, before her period, but equally she can have period-like pain at any time during her cycle. And the level of pain that women will experience can be anything from, you know, I take a few pain-relieving medications, paracetamol, something like that, and it's enough to, they can't get out of bed and they're going to the emergency room for injectables and, you know, all sorts of different things because the pain is so severe. I guess one of the most challenging parts of pain with endometriosis is what we know is that the level of pain that a woman experiences does not actually correlate with the level of severity of the condition. And she may actually have an extremely severe case, but actually not experience too much pain. And they're not equivalent and they're not equal. So pain's not a diagnostic. But, you know, the classic patient is the woman that has very heavy periods, very painful periods, lots of other symptoms around her period. And it's almost like she can't function for a few days to even a couple of weeks of her menstrual cycle. Obviously, as she gets older, it will affect her ability to conceive. And so sometimes it's only diagnosed when she's trying to have a baby because her ability to conceive has been compromised. And another hallmark of symptoms are symptoms that correlate with her digestive system. And these might be bloating, you know, after certain foods, misdiagnosis of things like irritable bowel syndrome. So she'll have alternating constipation and diarrhea, or, you know, frequent diarrhea and things like that, or even frequent constipation. But the bloating is such a diagnostic. And similarly, she often has urinary symptoms. So women that have frequent urinary tract infections or discomfort when they're urinating when they've got their period, or, you know, lots of urinary tract infections that cause kidney pain. These are all very, very common symptoms of women with endometriosis. And what I sort of like to do with women when they present in clinic is take a really full history, you know, looking at urinary symptoms, digestive symptoms, menstrual symptoms, but then all these weird and wonderful things like, you know, she may have lots of discomfort when she's having sexual intercourse. She may have vaginal thrush, vaginal, you know, dysbiosis types of things, funny discharges and stuff that have a cyclical pattern. You know, the woman with endometriosis, she's got so many different symptoms, but you have to take the full gamut of it to get the overview, to get an understanding, to go, the whole system, the whole body has been affected here.
Absolutely. No, thank you for explaining that. And I think a lot of women will resonate with that. And as you say, it's a very debilitating condition that, you know, women can be in bed for days or even a couple of weeks with it, can't they?
Absolutely.
So what causes endometriosis? And, you know, when does it usually present in a woman's life? Is it something that, you know, will happen around puberty, or is it sort of later on, or can it be anytime?
Sadly, it can be anytime. You know, like I've had women where they've gone through their entire menstrual years and they've only been diagnosed with endometriosis after menopause. But the common presentation is Unfortunately, it can take up to 10 years to get a diagnosis based on latest research, which means that a woman can go through her first period, average age is 11 to 12 years of age, and it takes her till she's 21 or 22 to get a diagnosis, which is diabolical. You know, you think about women where they're missing entire chunks of life. You know, some women that will come and present to me, it's ever since I had my first period, you know, the period pain has worsened over time. And that is a hallmark of endometriosis. It tends to get worse over time if treatment doesn't intercept and assist. But I'll often either see women where, you know, they're after getting their periods, maybe 1 or 2 years in, and their period pain is so debilitating, or it's when they want to have a baby. And they haven't been able to have a baby. And everyone's told them, it's just period pain, take some medication, go on the pill, you'll be fine. And then lo and behold, they can't conceive. And women are pretty amazing. I think their pain threshold is almost misunderstood. You know, the level of pain that women experience when they have endo, and they just put it aside. They just soldier on and keep going. But when it comes to having a baby, they kind of go, oh, maybe something's wrong. And then it's discovered. And that's when they unfortunately get the diagnosis.
No, absolutely. And we're led to believe that, you know, all these sort of, you know, the pain and everything, it's just normal, isn't it, around your period. And, you know, you just got to get on and deal with it. So, but, you know, for these young, you know, what young women or young girls that sort of getting it, it must be, it's a horrible thing for them to have to deal with because, as you say, they're sort of 11, 12, 13 and got all this, you know, immense pain going on and having to go to school, etc. So
I have to say, though, I love it because I think women that are, you know, in their teens now are so much more educated than, let's say, I was when I was in my teens. And I love it because, you know, they'll inquire to make an appointment or they'll make an appointment to see me and they'll have researched, they'll have listened to podcasts, they'll have read articles. They are such health advocates now in their early teens. I'm so impressed by them. I'm so confident, like so much more confident about women of that generation, because I think that the amount of knowledge that they have, they know that it's wrong. So I know that the work that we're all doing is so much more beneficial versus my generation when I was, you know, of that age of getting periods and stuff. We were just medicated. The doctor knew best. We didn't understand what the hell was going on. And it was very, very different. So I think there's a lot of hope for women with endo now, which is great.
Absolutely. And we're so lucky to have pioneers like you just leading the way and sharing all this information to get it into the hands of young women. So that's amazing. So now, are there any particular environmental, dietary and lifestyle factors that contribute to endometriosis and exacerbate symptoms?
Yes, absolutely. I apologize. I didn't answer that part of your question. There's quite a lot of theories around endometriosis. You know, like the oldest theory is from the 1920s, which talks about retrograde menstrual blood flow, which is technically the theory was that menstrual blood, instead of coming out in a downward manner, would go up and then would pool in the uterus and then that would cause endometriosis. And we know that there are elements of that in an endometriosis patient, but we know that that's not definitive as to what it is. The conventional gynecological community is still looking at it through a hormonal lens. They see it as an inflammatory condition, so that there's too much inflammation in the area, but they still are predominantly only using hormonal agents or pain relieving medications. So they still think that it's a hormonal condition. But some of the newer theories as to how endometriosis develops and why it progresses are things along the lines of, like what you were mentioning, environmental aspects. So we know that women are exposed to more environmental pollutants, and those environmental pollutants, particularly the things that are in the realm of what are known as xenobiotics or hormone-mimicking agents, which are predominantly in the world of plastics and chemicals and other agents like that. You know, a woman can lower her endometriosis risk, but also her endometriosis incidence purely by changing her personal care products. So we know that the amount of chemicals that are in personal care products are alarming. And it's really important to understand, you know, the ingredients that are on your products and to look at things really carefully, because it significantly interferes with hormone pathways and it perpetuates that inflammation in the body, which perpetuates endometriosis. And I guess one of the biggest things to get across to the you know, people that are listening, as soon as you have a cell that is an endometriosis cell, its proliferation, its growth is something that we can control with things that we do. And we can certainly prevent it from recurring once it's removed, and we can reduce its recurrence and we can reduce its spread. And things that we expose ourselves to from an environmental perspective are really strong agents in that regard. So just changing your cleaning products, just changing your personal care products, just stopping using plastic wraps and plastic containers and, you know, all of the soft plastics makes so much difference. You know, just what you drink your water out of, just what you drink your morning coffee out of makes an enormous difference to women with endometriosis. Other things to think about, there is definitely enough evidence now to be fairly conclusive around the bacterial hypothesis, which means that there is a triggering infection and identification of whatever that infection might be. In my clinical practice, I tend to see that it can be infections that are, you know, within the digestive system, within the urinary system, within the gynecological systems, and identification of those infections, treatment, eradication, and then replenishment and modulation of the microbiome. So all the good bugs within those areas can literally reverse endometriosis for women. So you can do a number of different tests to get an understanding of this thing called the microbiome, and you can establish if the balance of the bugs that are present within all those systems are healthy and in balance, and treatments that you do to eradicate those ones that are pathogenic, it's unbelievable what I'll see for patients, and it's unbelievable how it will change things. And so I think that's a really important area for patients when I work with them. And it amazes me how many patients I'll see in clinic where they go, oh, I've always had thrush. That's just always been me. Or I've always had a burning uterus feeling, or I've always had discomfort after intercourse, or, you know, and you eradicate those infections that are around those situations, and lo and behold, all those symptoms eradicate. Another main area that I think is important to highlight is around something called methylation. So methylation is essentially a process that occurs in every single human being. And it's essentially, it's like an exchange of chemical compounds and where we attach chemical compounds into certain reactions in the body. And the simplified version that I sort of explain to people is that it's essentially the speed with which our body does everything, how well we assimilate toxins, how well we absorb nutrients, how well we process and manufacture hormones, neurotransmitters. And we know that women with endometriosis, that methylation process is glitchy. So what is it within the body that tells that cell to be a healthy cell? And what is it that tells that cell to behave like an endometrial cell? Comes back to methylation. And so some women, their methylation is usually underfunctioning in women with endometriosis. And when we tidy up that methylation process, which we can do by doing a little bit of testing and supplementing them with the right nutrients and things and tidying up their diet, we can change those pathways and change the signaling that tells those cells how to behave. And there's an amazing amount of evidence around methylation and endometriosis, but we know around methylation and things like longevity and lifespan research and all those real buzzwords at the moment, it's pretty powerful stuff. And I always sort of explain to patients, you know, endometriosis is like a defunct or a defective aging process as well in the body. But they're probably some of the main areas that I look at with patients.
Wow, that's amazing. Thank you for explaining that. And you, as you say, you know, the plastics and chemicals, it's shocking, isn't it? Wasn't around 20 years ago. And we really do have to look at, you know, what we're putting on our skin, what we're cleaning our houses with, you know, as well as the things we're eating and the water. That's a big one too. You know, filtered water with a very good quality filter is essential. Do genetics and stress have an impact on endometriosis?
Genetics definitely do. So with genetics, I sort of, in my brain, I split them into two. So one is the genetics of mum had endometriosis, my sister has endometriosis. There's a really strong pattern and development of this disease in the family. So clearly there are genetics that we have some understanding of that increase your risk around endometriosis. And there's some beautiful twin studies. So twin studies are always used when we're trying to understand genetics and genetic play, for want of a better word, you know, how it develops in individuals. And so we know that there is an aspect of that, but there's also another area of genetics that I would associate with endometriosis, which is nutrigenomics, which are the genes that correlate with some of our nutrient pathways and our biochemistry and how we switch disorders on and off and things that feed into all of those pathways. But the biggest thing with genetics, both just familial genetics and then the nutrigenomic genetics, is epigenetics. And epigenetics is whatever I do with my diet, my lifestyle, my emotional well-being, my stress levels, my sleep, determines if that gene has been switched on or off. And so that sort of ties into that stress aspect, which is the more stressed out a woman is, of course, more of her pathways are not going to work as well, because she is going to make certain genes go on. You know, you think about a woman who is sleeping 3 to 4 hours a night versus 8 hours a night, or a woman who is under stress where that fight or flight response is so turned on that her body's adrenaline production and cortisol utilization is in such high demand, of course she's not going to be having normal pathways. It's going to affect so many other pathways in her body. But, you know, I think at the moment, sleep research is probably the most conclusive. You know, the sleep research and how we understand, you know, there's amazing papers that look at shift workers because they're obviously the best cohort of individuals that have sleep deprivation and sleep changes. And we know that women that are shift workers have a higher chance of developing and having aggravation of endometriosis and infertility for that matter.
Yeah, sleep is huge. And I think we can't underestimate, you know, how it affects our health, because, you know, there are people that have got this chronic insomnia, or they go to bed at like 12, 1 consistently, and that sleep deficit every night, it's just racking up, isn't it? And contributing to so many issues in the body.
Yeah, yeah. And it's so cumulative. And I think with sleep, we get on that pattern with it all where we just keep going and we push and we push and we push until the body screams at us in one way or another. And endometriosis is one of those ways. And I do think that, you know, the beauty of the menstrual cycle, one of the beauties of it, is the ability to always have a recharge, you know, like a clear out and a reset each month, to take stock, to look at things. And women naturally get more tired around their menstrual period. They naturally, you know, as their hormone changes before they start bleeding, they naturally feel that sedative aspect for a reason, so that we slow down, so that we allow the period, you know, to pass from our bodies, and we allow our bodies to shift into different cycles and different changes. And the wisdom behind that of the body helps us to remember, you know, to tidy up our sleep, you know, our poor sleep hygiene, for want of a better description. Hopefully, if we can attune ourselves to the rhythms of our body and the rhythm of our environment around us, that can helpfully get us to retune.
Absolutely. And I'm glad you touched on the epigenetics, because that's just absolutely fascinating. So how would someone go about testing their epigenetics? Where would they go to get that done?
So with the epigenetics, because it's essentially around what I eat, what my lifestyle is like, how much sleep I have, what my nutrition is like. Let's say you saw a naturopath and they were trying to ascertain if the gene was on or off. They could do specific studies to look at, you know, a particular nutrient and if there was a deficiency and how that correlated with the system. But with nutrigenomics, so let's say we look at methylation, for example. So with nutrigenomics, you could look at all of the genes that could be glitchy and could impact a methylation pathway. And so nutrigenomic testing, you see a qualified professional, they can look at some gene studies. And then there are some beautiful tests where, let's say for methylation, you could look at something called a methylation profile. And a methylation profile looks at the actual substances on the particular pathways, so that the clinician could actually look at that and go, this is working or this isn't working. And then, for example, with methylation, let's say in the endometriosis woman, it's, as I mentioned, they're often underfunctioning. Then the epigenetics would be that the lack of sleep, the higher stress, the lack of magnesium, the lack of glycine, whatever it might be, I could, let's say, test for that to get a sense of it and go, your epigenetics is impacting this particular pathway, so I know that this gene has been switched on. Does that make sense?
It does, absolutely. No, thank you for explaining that. Fascinating stuff.
It's an amazing time in medicine, you know. I think we've got so much power with testing. And I really think that we're in this age where we have this access to all of these phenomenal tests to really understand our bodies. I'm such an advocate of testing people at least twice a year of some of their basic markers and some of the deeper functional tests. I think we should do probably on a yearly basis, because it gives us such an insight. You know, I can test a person's genetics and that's really fascinating. And oh my God, the geek in me loves it. But I want to know, is that gene on or off? You know, I want to get an understanding of, is the pathway working or isn't it? And then the most powerful is, you know, you see the person and you give them a treatment recommendation, both lifestyle, dietary, supplemental, whatever, and you see how the pathway has been fixed, and that correlates with their improvement in symptoms. And that's just where the beauty comes in.
Absolutely. No, we are really lucky. We sort of have a lot of things at our fingertips now to help us with patients. So that's really amazing. So talking about testing, what are some of the routine tests that are carried out for endometriosis, and what specific tests do you recommend to determine if someone has endo or not? Because I know you've touched on a few of those, but are there any more that that women can consider?
So if we take endometriosis and we take a formal diagnosis, which needs to be organized through a gynecologist, the gold standard is a laparoscopy where they get a visual appearance of what's actually going on in there. The pros and cons of a laparoscopy, obviously it's a surgery, there are risks associated with it, but the pros are the visualization of what's actually happening, and a really skilled gynecologist can have a really good look and can see any other surrounding organs that may or may not be affected. The cons of a laparoscopy, other than the surgical risk, are that the challenge of endometriosis as a disease is that women have an increased risk of scarring. And so every time they have an incision, it increases their scarring. And then they develop these unusual scars called adhesions, which are where the scars kind of get quite bulbous and quite thick, and they can make organs or sections of organs stick together. So each time they have a surgery, the situation can actually get a lot worse. So if anyone that's listening, it's really important that you see someone that has very specialized training for endometriosis, because not all gynecologists will have it. In Australia, where I am, there's particular classifications and criteria that I'll always look for. And I certainly only work with a number of clinicians that I know that are expert at it. But technology's advanced so much, particularly in the last 10 to 15 years, where a woman can get a specialized women's ultrasound. So this is not just an ultrasound at any sonography place, but a specialist women's center, where they do, in Australia, we just colloquially call it an endo scan. You know, they'll do an internal and an external ultrasound, but when it's an endo scan, they'll get a woman to do a bowel prep before she has the scan, which gives them better visibility of the digestive organs. And equally, when the internal ultrasound is being completed, they'll use the probe as well as external palpation through the abdomen to move the organs around. And so then they can ascertain if the organs have what we call fixation, which is where the organs are getting a bit stuck, which is a hallmark of endometriosis, because that can be indicative of that scar tissue formation. And obviously when they do the ultrasound, they can see if there are very large masses of what are known as endometriomas, which are kind of like big congealed masses of those endometriosis-like cells. Of endometriosis or endometrial-like cells. So the ultrasound is an amazing diagnostic tool, especially because you don't have to go through surgery. If you're looking at it through blood work, though, I tend to use something called a CA125, which is actually a cancer marker, and it's used to diagnose reproductive cancers. It goes in and out of fashion in the gynecological community, but I find that it's very, very helpful because it is a marker for reproductive inflammation. So if a patient has an elevated level, then I know that there's something that's not quite right within the reproductive area. There's too much inflammation in there. And then that prompts further assessments and, you know, other ways with which to try and work out what's going on. If you test her estrogen levels, you'll often find that they're higher than in other women. So that can be something that you sort of piece together with your diagnosis. But then if you look at it through the functional lens, you know, she's got an established diagnosis, then I do all of my other tests that I find absolutely essential. So we talked about the nutrigenomics, so I'll look at the genes in that regard. I'll look at a methylation profile to get an assessment around methylation for her. I'll often do digestive microbiome profile to get an assessment of both from a healthy microbiome perspective, but as well as underlying pathogens that can drive endometriosis. I'll often do a vaginal microbiome profile as well, because, you know, 99% of the time there's a disruption in the vaginal microbiome that can both direct and assist with treatment suggestions. Other assessments that I find really helpful, almost all women with endometriosis have very high copper levels. So it's really important to do, in Australia and in the US, we call it a FIFA profile, which is, FIFA is the name of an orthomolecular psychiatrist in the 60s that looked at levels of B6, zinc, magnesium, manganese, copper, histamine, and a whole host of other biochemical markers. And they can give us an understanding of how the body metabolizes those substances, because we know that women with endometriosis are very prone to being deficient in zinc and have too much copper. And copper levels rise because they tend to have too much estrogen in their body, or they've had lots of copper exposure through environment and diet, or they've been on the contraceptive pill or used other hormonal agents that can keep that level up. And it's beautiful to see when you lower those copper levels in those women, how that improves their symptoms. Other tests that I find really important are obviously things that can both treat endometriosis but are a cause from endometriosis. simple things like iron studies, full blood count, looking at her red cells, looking at her immune health, looking at her vitamin D, looking at her general inflammatory markers. And sometimes in women, I'll see liver function abnormalities as well that I can see a definitive correlation. And I also think it's really important to rule out things like celiac disease, rule out hemochromatosis, which is an iron storage disorder, other things that are, you know, really correlative and can be really helpful to identify. You know, I guess the biggest thing to get across is that I see endometriosis kind of like a systemic syndrome. I don't see it just as a, you know, a reproductive disorder with some period pain. I see it as a syndrome, and so much of the body is affected. So I really want to get a wide view of where her body's at, because a little bit of this and a little bit of that seems to produce the disease.
Absolutely. Yes, you've sort of got to go into so much depth. And I imagine it's different for every woman that presents. There's going to be different things going on, and you'll be looking at different tests, obviously. So that will give our listeners a lot more detail to go on, because as you say, you know, the normal routine tests that are done sort of at the GP are not going to give that full picture, are they? So now we've talked briefly about the gut, you know, in terms of gut health and the immune system as well in relation to endometriosis. Could you sort of go into that a little bit more detail, just about how those two systems are linked to the condition?
I think the approach that I think that's that I'll take is looking at it through the lens of the microbiome. So we talked a little bit about the microbiome before, and essentially the microbiome is the concept that we live in harmony with bugs. So some research says it's, you know, within the 50th percentile, some say as high as the 80th percentile, but essentially we're all bugs with a little bit of other bits and pieces in there as well. And the balance of those bugs determine our health. So a woman with endometriosis, you know, we know that her bug balance, for want of a simplification, is very, very disrupted. We know that, you know, the digestive system is both the second brain, and we also know that it is the most important component of a person's immune system. So a dysbiotic digestive system, and so that's where the bacterial colonization is out of whack and out of balance, and it's got too much unhealthy bacteria in there, we know that that causes a significant reduction in immune health. And we know that women with endometriosis 99.999% of the time have a digestive system which is not healthy balance, and their immune system is not in a healthy balance either. And so this is where, you know, there are other theories around endometriosis where they talk about it being an autoimmune condition. I don't know that I think of it as an autoimmune condition, but I certainly think of it that there is that bacterial hypothesis that I talked about before, but also that the immune system is a bit deranged. And I say that word from a scientific perspective, not from a disrespectful perspective. The immune system is not very healthy in a woman with endometriosis. Her immune system is often more reactive. She's more sensitive to things, but it's much more around she has an immune history. So any woman with endometriosis that sits in front of me, she'll have some sort of digestive history. Oh, you know, I've never been well since that traveler's bug that I got in the Middle East, you know, or I was always the one that was really healthy until I got glandular fever when I was 11, and then I've had every virus since, or I'm very prone to cold sores, and I'm very prone to a sore throat all the time. With her endometriosis, she always has signs that her immune system is compromised. So some women I'll need to look at, you know, just go back to that testing thing. Some women I'll need to go back to her immune system in more detail and really get a deep dive into, you know, components of her white cells and components of how her immune system works and how effective it is. Because some women with endometriosis have lots and lots of autoimmune conditions, and they have an immune system that never shuts down, that never quietens down. And interestingly, it always comes back to her gut. And if I stabilize her gut and I rebalance her gut microbiome, her resilience is so much stronger, but everything calms down. And it's like there's a storm in women with endometriosis. And in Chinese medicine, you know, they talk about the fire in the reproductive system. They talk about this dampness, and they talk about that there's, you know, there's too much stagnation. But they talk about this fiery stagnation and this redness to the blood and everything. And it's such a diagnostic in Chinese medicine, because it's really how, you know, you think of endo, and, you know, if any of the listeners are visual like I am, you know, I always sort of see diseases almost like their colors and their textures. And to me, endometriosis is fiery and red and stagnant and clotted. And it's, you know, it's almost like their menstrual blood. And you soothe the gut, you sort out the microbiome, and that helps it in ways that never cease to surprise me. And I guess one of the most beautiful things that I always see with women with endometriosis is, you fix their gut and you fix their microbiome. And the first thing they'll always say to me is, I'm calm now. You know, I'm happy and I'm calm now. And what a gift. That's so beautiful.
That's amazing. And yeah, and I love that, you know, the way you've described that there, that fiery stagnation. I think that's the perfect way to describe endo. Well, that leads us on quite nicely to the naturopath's approach to endometriosis. You know, what are some of the key steps in managing endometriosis, and what are your dietary and lifestyle recommendations?
So key steps with endometriosis. So first is get a proper diagnosis and look at where you're at. And I think getting a really good healthcare team, you know, to go full circle to the beginning, get a really good healthcare team for people is so important. I think, you know, it's simplistic for anyone within the endometriosis space to think that they can do it all, because no one can. You know, we need a good gynecologist that has specific expertise in the area. We need a good naturopath for obvious reasons, for all the things that I'm outlining. You know, they might need an exercise physiologist. They generally always need a really good pelvic floor physio, because there are physiological aspects to it. You know, all the pain that they experience, they need someone to help guide them around what is, you know, hypertone to their pelvic floor, what is hypotone to their pelvic floor, because they tend to overstrengthen certain muscles and weaken certain muscles, which perpetuates that pain cycle and the discomfort that they experience day to day. So the healthcare team is number one. The assessments to get a sense and to establish what's going on and what are their drivers. So not everyone will have methylation glitches, microbiome glitches, prior infection. Not everyone will have every single aspect. It's work out what are we dealing with, prioritize it, and then create a sequential flow to how you're going to approach it. We can't sit there as clinicians and go, look, if I take gluten out of your diet, we'll talk more about that in a second. If I take gluten out of your diet, I fixed everything, because absolutely you haven't. But it's what's the priority and where am I going to bring the greatest stability to this person? And I always sort of, when I lecture, you know, to colleagues and things, or I supervise them, you know, we always talk around, how can I bring the greatest strength of foundation to this person so that I can build on that and I can help them move forward and strengthen and you know, get greater health in so many different ways. And so it's about identification of what's the biggest driver, biggest cause, fix that first, and then organize things from then on. So if we move that into, let's say, dietary and lifestyle, and then, you know, specific treatments, from a dietary perspective, the bulk of the research centralizes around a gluten-free and dairy-free diet. I think gluten-free is almost 100% of the time indicated, whereas dairy, some women can get away with it. And I think that comes back to their genetics. So some women, I'll find that they can get rid of, you know, the differentiation between A1 and A2 milk. So in Australia, it's much more simplistic, but you guys have more natural access to A2 milk, being Jersey cows versus Friesian. But a woman that, let's say, you know, I always use this and I say, if you have French brie and you have no reaction, or you have Italian parmesan and you have no reaction, but you have liquid milk and you do, it may be around the fermentation of the dairy, or it may be around the dairy source, or it may be around the animal source. And so let's work out which one you can tolerate and which one you can't. So endo women can usually tolerate buffalo mozzarella, for example, because it's not aged. It's a different type of milk, which is more A2 based, which relates to the protein structure within the milk. So it's usually more tolerated by women versus liquid cow milk from an A1 cow, i.e. a Friesian cow. She often has more inflammatory reaction to that and more exacerbation of symptoms. Gluten, on the other hand, I think it's important to test her to work out if she's an undiagnosed celiac, because that certainly happens a lot, and to look at the genetics around celiac, not just the serology. But removal of it, you know, within gluten, we have gliadin, which is again the protein, and it's such an inflammatory driver and it interferes with the gut microbiome in such a negative way that it's never healthful. You know, it's never a healthy option for anyone. So that's why I tend to go, as a blanket rule, remove it because it just causes so much inflammation and interferes with absorption of nutrients just on a simple level. So I find removing it is really helpful. You know, furthermore, with dietary, I don't think alcohol helps anyone with endo, but that tends to come more from a group of substances called amines, which are from protein degradation. And amines tend to occur in foods that are aged or fermented or older. So you're thinking things like alcohol, aged cheeses, but it's also in things like chocolate, unfortunately. It's in things like coffee. It's in high moldy foods, which include things like coffee and chocolate, but obviously also include things like blue cheeses and aged cheeses. But also, you know, moldy foods can be things like rock melon or cantaloupe, depending on the country that you're in, or watermelon. So amine foods, I find that women tend to need to remove it entirely and then challenge foods, and they'll see if they have a reaction to it. But, you know, women with endometriosis that are very prone to migraines and headaches, they tend to be the ones that are more sensitive to foods high in amines versus those that aren't. From a lifestyle perspective, as I mentioned before, you know, the pelvic floor physio idea is really, really important. But exercise is really important for women with endometriosis because of that blood stagnancy. So they need to exercise every day. They need to stretch every day. And they need to identify the type of exercise that is really useful for their body, not too taxing on their body. So women with endometriosis tend not to thrive on running, but they tend to thrive on things like yoga and Pilates, things that stretch the body, strengthen their core, you know, exercise the right muscles, in inverted commas, the muscles that assist with structure and form as opposed to tension, because they often exercise the wrong muscles. So, you know, thinking about things like that is really important. And, you know, all the other lifestyle things that we spoke about earlier, you know, removing environmental pollutants and toxins, making really conscious choices around personal care products, conscious choices around simple things like the washing detergent, particularly the washing detergent on their underwear, the material of their underwear, the types of sanitary products that they use, the types of contraception that they use. All of these things make so much difference to women with endometriosis, and really important not to underestimate it.
Thank you for that. That's absolutely amazing. And you covered so many things there. And I think, you know, as you say, the alcohol, the coffee, the chocolate, these are probably things that women with endo, before, without realizing, are potentially consuming on a daily basis. And I think, as you say, just removing that and gluten makes such a difference, you know, before you even covered any of the other things that you do in practice. So, diet and lifestyle is huge. So are there any specific nutrients and herbs that are helpful?
Absolutely. Without a doubt, there's lots and lots of wonderful things that we can do. I think it's about identification of what the person needs and making sure that, you know, like if every single person with endo took vitamin D, for example, it might work, it might not work. It's about identification of where your body's at, what you need specifically for you. And some of the nutrients, the most fascinating part about nutrient prescriptions with women with endo is some of the nutrients make it worse. And two of the nutrients that make it worse if it's incorrectly prescribed or at the wrong time of the equation of treatment are vitamin D and iron. So iron's one of those ones that's probably the most controversial, because you think about a woman with endometriosis, heavy periods, undoubtedly she's always anemic unless she has hemochromatosis. And I've had a few women where that happens, and that's an overstorage of iron disorder. It's a genetic disorder, but assuming it's more the common scenario where she's deficient. And so the first thing often clinicians do, or even just people do, is they go, oh, I need to take some iron, and that makes it worse. And the reason behind that is that if it's a woman with endometriosis and it's been an infection that's driven the endometriosis, so maybe she has a gut parasite, maybe she has a bacteria in her gut or her vagina or her uterus or something like that, all of these pathogens feed off iron. So if you give them iron, then the pathogen gets worse, so the endo gets worse. So it's really important to know what you're doing. And even though it can sometimes feel counterintuitive, you know, you're sitting there with a woman and she's really anemic and you're like, oh my God, I just need to give her iron. You know, this is why women with endo, and they go and have an iron infusion or they have really high dose iron, and they go, I've never been right since I had that iron infusion. I've gotten so much worse since then. It's basically a diagnostic to tell you that she's got an infection that someone didn't treat and the infection benefited from it. So working it through and trying to work out what's what is really important. And equally, you know, fish oils is such a common prescription for women with endo. And fish oils, and again, another thing that I'm really controversial about, fish, unfortunately, is very difficult to get fish or fish oils nowadays that are clean. So you look at any of the research that look at, you know, what's in the ocean at the moment. The ocean is full of mycotoxins. It's full of these things called dinoflagellates, which are basically these subspecies of almost like parasites that are only found in the ocean. The ocean is full of all these unusual bacteria and parasites that we don't even have names for. It's full of environmental runoff. It's full of environmental pollutants. We know that, you know, you can have radiation crises in one country, and because of wind patterns, it's detectable in another country. So basically anything that's happening on the planet is in the ocean. So my rule of thumb with patients with consumption of things from the ocean, both dietary or supplemental, is where is it coming from? So the idea of wild-caught Alaskan salmon being, you know, the gold standard or the goalpost, for want of a better description, is unfortunately not that great, because wild-caught Alaskan salmon still has radiation from Japan, still has pollutants from the Middle East, from Russia, from wherever. So any of my women with endo, we talk about fish, and I talk about the idea of there might be certain farmed areas, and farm salmon is not great, just picking salmon as an example, but there are certain farmed areas. So New Zealand is close for us. There's Marlborough farms over there where they have this particular type of king salmon, and it's a completely well-contained environment and it's completely clean and all these wonderful things, and that fish is safe to eat. But anything wild-caught isn't. And, you know, the smaller fish are lower in heavy metals and things. Deeper fish are higher in heavy metals. But the same goes for our fish oils as supplements. And it's very difficult to get supplements that aren't full of all of the rubbish, because most of the companies are testing for things like mercury, but they're not necessarily testing for all of the other environmental pollutants. So really, really look at that carefully, because all of that makes endo so much worse. So if I bring it back to the original part of your question, you know, the biggest part of the prescriptions are things like berberine, or which is a phytochemical from certain plants, which is an amazing antimicrobial substance that's incredible at getting rid of some of the bacterial infections or even some of the parasitic infections that are associated with endometriosis. And that's often one of my number ones, because I want to identify what's the infection, and I'll use that in conjunction with other herbs, maybe garlic or oregano or pardako or other substances that will actually go in there and clean everything out first. And then I can repopulate the environment with probiotics, with prebiotics, with short chain fatty acid substances like butyrates and things, and feed all the good microbiome to actually build the person up to then look at key nutrients, which might involve iron or vitamin D or methylation factors like B12 and folate or zinc or molybdenum or lysine or whatever it might be. But it's first and foremost clear the slate. So I hope that's not too confusing. I just realized I went in a number of circles.
No, that's absolutely fantastic. And thank you so much for flagging up about the fish oils and about, you know, the iron and self-prescribing, because I think so many women will go, oh, my iron's low, or I'm feeling tired, and, you know, rush straight out and go and get some iron. And sometimes they're not going to get a quality iron, but you've just flagged up that, you know, that could do way more harm than good. So, you know, self-prescribing, you really need to get the advice of a practitioner and be working, as you say, with your team, because endo is such a complex condition, and it's there's so many factors to consider. So yeah, thank you for that. So are there any other natural therapies that can help with endometriosis and symptom relief, you know, other sort of modalities that might help?
Look, I'm a really big advocate of things like acupuncture, self-administered acupressure, things along those lines. I do think that essential oils are amazing, if for nothing else, just symptomatic relief. You know, there might be, there's certainly therapeutic benefits. So I'll often get women with difficult endometriosis to use things like coriander oil if they've got a really strong history of environmental toxins and pollutants that have built up over time. I'll get them to use the essential oil of clary sage for menstrual pain and discomfort. And clary sage is just so beautiful. And I'll often get them to combine that with peppermint oil as well. Peppermint oil is one of those things that I remember stumbling upon when I was about 12, with my own endometriosis, you know, and I put it on my abdomen, and it's so great at relieving pain and nausea and easing some of the digestive symptoms that go with it. And I'm a really big advocate of women doing castor oil packs or sesame oil packs to relieve the congestion and to drain the area, you know, because there's so much stagnation, as we've talked about quite a few times. And castor oil packs, you know, the idea is to get a cloth and soak it in a hexane-free organic castor oil or a really pure sesame oil and apply heat on top of it, which really sinks into the tissues and helps to break it down and helps women to, you know, relieve some of the stagnation and move things in the area. And I find that that works really, really well. It's just important that women don't do it when they're actively bleeding, because it can make them bleed for longer. And, you know, I find that massage, interestingly enough, with the essential oil of rose is really good for women when they have built up adhesions and scarring. You know, like I'll often say to women after they'll have a laparoscopy or they've had a surgery in the past, I'll get them to use some rose oil once the wound has healed, rose oil to massage to relieve the scarring. And if they can get themselves a moxa stick, which is used in Chinese medicine, and a moxa stick is some herbs that are in a long stick, and it basically provides heat and smoke to an area. And careful not to touch the skin, but you can use the heat with some rose essential oil underneath it, and that can be beautiful to help break down all that scarring to enable to have a lot of movement to the area. And, you know, and another thing that I'm a really big advocate of is getting women to be really comfortable with their body and to understand the placement of everything internally as well as externally, and to get them to get some training from a pelvic floor physio, or I'll walk them through some training as well, just to understand how to massage the area. There are some handheld devices or even vibrators for that matter can do the same thing, to get them to stretch out certain muscles and to get them to relieve ligament tension in certain areas as well. And you can get them to do some Pilates exercises and external massages and then internal massages as well. And that can give them so much relief and so much benefit, because you can imagine, you know, like these women are in pain extensively, you know, around their menstrual period, but certainly throughout the month they can experience pain just on a daily basis whenever they want to relieve their bowels or urinate for that matter. And just starting to get relief in those areas and starting to be aware of when their tension is there or when it's relieved, that can really empower them in so many wonderful ways.
Absolutely. And these are all things that they can do at home themselves, isn't it? You're saying, like, with the peppermint oil, the rose oil massage, the castor oil packs, they're all, you know, easy things to do at home. So that's amazing. Thank you, Lea. So just to finish off, what is the one key takeaway from today, your biggest piece of advice for anyone experiencing endometriosis?
I guess the number one thing I would say is, firstly, anything that deviates from a simple regular cycle where you bleed for that small amount that we spoke about at the beginning of this podcast, you know, 80 to 120 mils of blood, no pain, bright red blood, no clots, no discomfort. You know, you're aware that you're bleeding, but nothing that really interferes with your life. If it deviates from that, it is not normal. Pain is not normal. And it really, I want women to hear this, to go, it's not normal to experience period pain. It means that something is amiss in your body. It means that you deserve healthcare. You deserve someone to support you. You deserve a team to listen to you. And if your clinician isn't helping you or isn't listening to you, it's time to move on. And it's time to be your own health advocate and to find people that respect you and help you to understand your body as much as you possibly can. Because you can reclaim your health from endometriosis. You can improve your health. You can reverse it. You can certainly recover from it. And I don't want women to be left there going, oh, this is all that it's ever going to be. I'm going to be in this level of discomfort, because that's not the case.
No, absolutely not. And I love that. That's a fantastic piece of advice. And I know that will give hope to so many of our listeners. Well, thank you so much for sharing all your wisdom with us. It's been phenomenal, and I know it's going to help so many of our listeners. Now, where can people find more information about you and the work you do, Lea?
Thank you, firstly. I've really appreciated it as well. They can just jump online to my website, which is www.naturalhealthfertility.com, And then there's heaps of blogs and podcasts and all sorts of other interesting bits and pieces there.
Amazing. Yes, you've got phenomenal amounts of information on there. So, and as one of CNM's patrons, you're going to be creating a lecture series on reproductive health for CNM, which is amazing. As the leading expert on this complex system, I know the lectures are going to be so informative and inspiring. So yes, we're looking forward to seeing those in the near future.
As am I. Yeah, it's a real privilege to certainly be a part of the college and to be a patron, but to be invited to do those lectures, I'm really grateful and humbled for it. And I really can't wait. I haven't, you know, sort of been connected to undergraduate education for a little while, and I'm really, really excited by it. You know, it's so nice to connect to, you know, the burgeoning, growing industry. So I'm looking forward to it.
Absolutely. We're so excited too and can't wait. So thank you again, Leah. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you so much, Michelle. My privilege.
Well, that's all we've got time for today. Thanks for listening, and a big thank you to Leah for sharing her wealth of knowledge and experience with us. You can find all the information discussed today and more about Leah in the show notes on the CNM website at www.cnmpodcast.com. And if you're interested in learning more about nutrition, herbal medicine or naturopathy, check out CNM's range of short courses and more comprehensive diploma training courses. We have a series of open events coming up, and you can find all the details on the CNM website at www.naturopathy-uk.com. Thanks so much for joining us today. If you enjoyed the show, make sure you subscribe through your favourite podcatcher so you don't miss any future episodes. While you're there, we'd love it if you could leave us a rating or review, as this helps us when creating new content.